You're listening to Pythagoras' Trousers.
Hello and welcome to this month's Pythagorean Astronomy with me, Chris North.
And me, Edward Gomez.
So first of all, let's start far afield. We'll go to a distant galaxy where back in January this year, an incredibly bright flash of gamma rays was seen, a very, very bright gamma ray burst, seen by telescopes up in space, SWIFT and Fermi, the two telescopes that look for X-rays and gamma rays, and I believe for the first time by a ground-based gamma ray telescope in the Canary Islands called MAGIC. And the new development here is that observations have been made with Hubble, which is not a gamma ray telescope.
Yeah, that's right. And the so what you tend to have with these gamma ray observatories is that they are very low resolution. They tend to be surveys, so they want to look at large patches of the sky. And so they can't pinpoint exactly where on the sky. They can just tell you the vague area, and then it's for other observatories to go and then follow up. This is something that happens a lot in astronomy. You have survey ones with a very wide field of view, and then you have follow-up observatories which have a narrower field of view. And in this case, Hubble did the follow-up, and although it's not looking at gamma rays, it's looking at the afterglow after whatever the gamma ray, whatever caused the gamma rays, because the gamma ray burst was very, very short. It was only a few seconds, but actually, in gamma ray standards, that's quite a long burst.
Yeah.
It was incredibly high energy as well, and that's, in the future, I'm sure there'll be lots of interesting research about why that was such high energy. But the follow-up observations by Hubble indicate that these gamma rays emanated from the center of a galaxy. The galaxy was quite far away. It was about 5 billion light years away. It's relatively local. 5 billion light years sounds like a very long distance, but actually it's relatively local. The galaxy will have been a normal type of galaxy. It wouldn't have been something like in the dim distance past of the universe. And it's most likely to have been something that very, very intense concentrated part at the center of the galaxy that caused these gamma rays.
I think they did see when the galaxy came from is a pair of colliding galaxies. So although it's not a very, very far away, it is in a slightly unusual situation in that they're colliding. And maybe that's had something to do with why there was this whatever went on in the center of one of the galaxies.
Yeah, this concentration of all the pressure from the collision or the merger caused the gamma rays.
So no real clues as to what this was other than something very bright and energetic, but as you say, there's a huge follow-up efforts to try and track these down. Coming closer to something that was also a very energetic event, a bit more recent than 5 billion years ago, something from 32 years ago, February 1987, was a flash of light seen, or a new object seen, in the Large Magellanic Cloud. Now known to be a supernova, or shortly after identified to be a supernova, called Supernova 1987A, the first one seen in 1987. This was the explosion of a massive star, which has then been observed in huge detail for the last 30 years. It's only 160,000 light years away, or thereabouts. So it's very, very local.
Yeah, so although we saw it 30-plus years ago, it was actually... it was actually 160,000 years ago that the star exploded.
The observations of that have been looking for not just the afterglow, the material that's been thrown out into space, the clouds of dust and gas and so on, to figure out what's been created by that exploding star, but also to look for what was left in the centre. It's thought that these such stars should leave a neutron star, the dead husk of the dead core of a star that quite a lot more massive than our sun. That's not been seen yet.
Yes, and that's one of the really interesting things about this, because all the supernovae that we normally see, you normally eventually see a neutron star. You normally see it in radio, having a radio pulse, or in other ways. But this doesn't appear to have one. And this research suggests that it's obscured by cosmic dust, so that the dust is shrouding that, and the neutron star is heating up the dust, and that's why it looks abnormally bright in the wavelengths that they've been looking at, and then in a period of time, 30, 40 years, the dust will sort of blow away and you'll be able to see the neutron star that was being shrouded by this dust. It's also not in our galaxy as well. Mm. It's in one of the close neighbor galaxies to our Milky Way galaxy. It's in the Large Magellanic Cloud, which is a strange shaped, what we call an irregular galaxy. It's one of the two satellite galaxies that you can see as sort of fuzzy patches if you travel to the southern hemisphere.
You say in a period of time this dust will clear and we'll be able to see the neutron star. We have got other supernovae which, as you said, we can see the neutron stars in the center pulsing in radio waves and sometimes other wavelengths as well. But those are typically 1,000 years old. They're much older in terms of the event. So somewhere between 30 years and 1,000 years, this dust will...
Yeah,
clear. So it is fascinating to watch this evolving in real time.
Yeah,
to see it.
The majority of supernovae that we see are in much, much distant galaxies. So they're not as close as this, which is why this is has a special place in astronomers' hearts, because it's very close. Although it's in a separate galaxy, it's one of our not even neighbor galaxies. It's a satellite galaxy that's so close to us. It's just on the edge of the Milky Way galaxy. So we can really study it in really high detail and high precision.
It's also not too... It has got the clouds of material around it, but the supernovae we see in our own galaxy, which are closer, tend to be in the plane of our galaxy and they're behind other clouds of gas and dust. This doesn't have quite that...
Yeah, that's right.
Issue,
yeah.
Which is helpful. So we look forward to tracing that over the next 30, 40 years, see what happens to supernova 1987A as it evolves further. Coming into our solar system and the planet Jupiter, or one of the moons of the planet Jupiter, Europa. Now, Europa is often in the news for having evidence for it's got an icy surface, but water vapour on its or near its surface. It's a bit reminiscent of water on Mars stories, which seem to come around about every 6 months. But this was from a ground-based telescope, whereas the other detections have been from either spacecraft flying past Europa, such as Galileo in the 90s, or the Hubble Space Telescope, which is obviously in orbit around the Earth. Doing this from the ground, from within our own atmosphere, is particularly challenging when you're looking for water vapour.
Yeah, if you live in Wales, as we do, we're not any strangers to water vapour in the air, because clouds are essentially water vapour. But even on cloudless nights, there is a lot of water vapour in the air. And that's actually a major problem for astronomers, particularly for a special breed of astronomers that we have, particularly in the UK, called submillimeter astronomers. They're like radio astronomers, looking at a very particular colour of light that our eyes can't see. That is 95% of it is blocked by the water vapour in the Earth's atmosphere. So you have to go to the top of mountains so that you reduce the amount of the atmosphere that you're looking through out into space, and astronomers have successfully done this. It's not as good as sending out telescopes into space like the Herschel Space Observatory or other observatories, but there have been quite a lot of telescopes that have successfully observed astrophysical phenomenon that are emitting in these wavelengths.
Even at other wavelengths, even when you look at optical light, so this latest detection was using the Keck telescope, which is a 10-metre diameter telescope. It's pretty much the largest optical telescope on Earth. Looking at optical and near-infrared light to look for this water vapour, even with Keck being on the top of Mauna Kea in Hawaii, so over 4 kilometres in altitude, it's still not above, as you say, all that water vapour. They have to do really complex modelling to figure out what the effect of our atmosphere on our observations is to try and remove that effect. So lots of sort of theoretical models feed into this as well. But it does seem to indicate that there was one particular place on Europa, the bit that was facing the Earth at the time. There was this plume, or was the evidence for water vapour. Two possible theories. One is that it was a plume, a jet of material coming up through the icy crust from a subsurface ocean that we're pretty sure is there. But also it could potentially have been from something hitting the icy surface and creating a cloud of material. I think there was enough to fill, you know, an Olympic swimming pool in minutes, I think was the statistic, an awful lot of water. So that kind of rules out the impact theory, is the feeling in the research paper. So it does seem to be this plume. And the exciting thing there is that if this plume of material is coming out from the subsurface ocean, we've got that water being ejected into space. We can then sample it, look at it, study it, and see what that water is like. Is it salty water? Has it got any, if we have a mission go there, would it find any contaminants in that water? Maybe even signs of, organic compounds and so on. That's the exciting thing about having water coming up from beneath the surface here.
And it's also, because it's coming up under high pressure, it's spreading out as it's coming out. And so without going there and actually taking a sample and doing a little chemistry experiment on it, you could analyze the light that's being emitted or being absorbed and then re-emitted by this cloud of water vapor. And potentially there are missions that could do that analysis in the pipeline.
Coming slightly closer into our asteroid belt, and the fourth largest object in the asteroid belt, an asteroid called Hygieia, which is now a contender for being the smallest dwarf planet in the solar system. So we should clarify what a dwarf planet is.
Yeah, so the solar system is separated into major planets and dwarf planets, and then moons and asteroids and things like that. But a dwarf planet is still a planet. It has to have collapsed under self-gravity so that it's spherical. It also has to have cleared its environment. So it has to have enough gravitational pull so that anything that was little bits of debris around it, it would have sucked them onto its surface by gravity and formed a nice spherical shape, which this does appear to have done.
And the distinction with a major planet, if you like, is that a major planet has to have cleared all the other stuff from its orbit or the similarly sized stuff in its orbit. This is in the asteroid belt. Well, there's an awful lot of big rocks there. This is a glorified big rock.
Yeah.
It's about 400-odd kilometres across, so it's a very big rock. This has been observed with the Very Large Telescope down in Chile with a very high-resolution instrument. That's observed that it seems to be round, it seems to be spherical, so that means it's not then just a bog-standard potato-shaped asteroid. It is this spherical object. That does mean it could classify as a dwarf planet, but there's a catch because it's possibly not got spherical in the same way that other dwarf planets have got spherical.
Yeah, it could have. An asteroid or a body out in space will form. It'll be in flux for a while everything's settling down and the rock and everything is cooling. And then over the course of billions of years, the strange shape, whatever it's settled in, gravity will pull it into a sphere. Now with this, it may have had an impact which made it remoltenize, and that makes it a lot easier for it to become spherical again.
Yeah. Shatter into lots of tiny pieces, which then will float together down into a sphere. So it may have had a cheat to get to the dwarf planet status. And it's not officially a dwarf planet. The International Astronomical Union is the body that sort of decides on these things, and no doubt there'll be a discussion at the next big meeting. As to what this should be classified as. But that would take us to six dwarf planets in the solar system. And there are lots out in the Kuiper Belt that are being observed all the time as well. So at some point, we're going to get many more dwarf planets.
I don't doubt it.
You're listening to Pythagorean Astronomy. And one of the things we've talked about over the past couple of months is this interstellar visitor, Borisov. We've not talked a lot about the observations to date, and I'm joined now by Professor Alan Fitzsimmons from Queen's University Belfast, who is involved in observations of this interstellar visitor. So, Alan, first of all, what have we found out about Borisov so far?
Well, the good news is that we've already found out much more than we had found out about our first interstellar visitor 2 years ago, Oumuamua. The reason for that is that, as you said, it's a comet. It's been warmed by the sun as it approaches its closest point to the sun in mid-December. That heat from the sun is sublimating or evaporating the surface ices, driving off that ice as gas. That gas has dust grains imparted on it, and we can measure this with the telescopes we've got trained on the comet. So we already know a lot more, as I said, about Borisov than we did about Oumuamua. The first thing we did was detect the dust particles ejected by the comet, and that's actually what gives the comet its coma or transient atmosphere and the short tail we can see in images from Earth. We've also managed to detect gas from the comet, something we never managed to do for Oumuamua. And the first thing we detected was cyanogen molecules. That's a carbon and a nitrogen atom bonded together. And that was really good because we detect that all the time in comets that belong to our own solar system. So we can immediately compare how much dust to gas there was there. And surprisingly to us, it looked relatively normal. If we didn't know this was an interstellar comet, then we would have just assumed it was just a normal solar system comet coming in from the Oort cloud that surrounds our solar system and gives us about half the comets that we actually observe with our telescopes. So we've got the gas and the dust. Now, since that first detection, we've detected other gases. Other astronomers have detected oxygen in the comet, and indeed I'm involved with two or three different projects observing this comet, and although we haven't announced the results yet, I can confirm we have detected other types of gas in this comet now. And so we're comparing this now very carefully with the normal makeup of comets in our own solar system. And so far it looks pretty normal, apart from one thing. There's a type of gas we normally see, which is carbon 2. That's two carbon atoms joined together to form a carbon molecule. And it's relatively depleted in this gas, in the sense that we don't see as many of those gas molecules as we would normally see in a comet belonging to our own solar system. And so this is clearly showing us one way that Borisov is different from the average comet we would normally study with our telescopes. But apart from that, at the moment, it's looking pretty standard, which is interesting when we realise it's come from a completely different solar system and could have formed in a completely different environment.
Now, you say that Borisov, it's you know, surprising that it's similar to comets in our own solar system. Do we have reasons to expect, or what reasons do we have to expect comets from another solar system to be different from comets from our solar system? I mean, how different can a dirty ice ball or a snowy dirt ball be between solar systems?
Well, that's a really good question. And up to now, we haven't been able to answer it because we haven't seen another active comet from another solar system. But when we look at our current theories and models of how solar systems form, we know that the relative amount of different gases, or in their frozen state, different ices that can be incorporated into a comet when it forms, varies quite a lot as you go from near or relatively near a newly born star to much further out. And so, for example, within our own solar system, we think all our comets that we see formed within the region of the giant planets, where somewhere between where Jupiter formed and Uranus and Neptune formed. In which case, maybe it's not a surprise that over that relatively small distance, and it was a smaller distance back at the birth of the solar system than it is today, the compositions between comets, the relative amounts of ices, would be roughly the same, and indeed that's what we see. But we go to different solar systems, and where with different structures of the disks of gas and dust that condense to form comets and planets, and we could have wildly different relative amounts of gases. So at the moment, it's still surprising that most of these gases look somewhat similar to what we measure for comets belonging to our sun. But saying that, we haven't measured them all yet. And in fact, the one thing we're still wanting to get a good handle on is how much water there is in Borisov, because we believe now water is the main constituent ice in the comet that is effectively boiling off and giving us this activity. And if we can measure that as well as the other gases, we'll have a much clearer idea of what this comet is like in terms of its chemical makeup.
And that's one of the things that I know with comets in our solar system, a big focus has been on the types of water involved, or the types of water that are there. So this is the water that we, you know, that we're used to with hydrogen and oxygen, and another type that's got a little bit of deuterium or heavy hydrogen mixed in. And that can tell us something interesting about the history of those comets. Is that something you'll be able to tell with Borisov?
Well, probably not, unfortunately, unless it undergoes a catastrophic fragmentation, in which case all the material is released at once. It would get much brighter, and then we'd be get enough signal with even the largest telescopes on Earth to detect that deuterated water, that deuterium in water molecules. But if Borisov keeps as active as it is now, we don't have a chance of measuring that. But all is not lost, because we can't predict what the next interstellar comet may look like, or the one after that. Now we've started discovering them. And if we go ahead, perhaps 10 years or so, this summer, the European Space Agency approved the Comet Interceptor mission for launch in 2028. And the idea is that that Comet Interceptor mission can go and visit nominally a new comet entering our solar system, but still belonging to our sun. But there's also the possibility it could encounter an interstellar comet. And the instruments on board Comet Interceptor would allow us to measure this, these ratios of these different types of water, and compare them with what we see not only on Earth, but throughout our solar system.
And this Comet Interceptor mission is a mission that's going to, well, the name implies, it's going to actually go to one of these comets. It's going to fly past them. So I guess it's not going to land, I assume.
That's right. No, it's because it will be aimed at a comet that's coming in for the first time from presumably the Oort cloud. This is this large spherical cloud of comets that surrounds our solar system. And generally, those are traveling too fast in such a trajectory that we could not stop and rendezvous, just as we did with the Rosetta mission at Comet 67P. But the good thing about the Comet Interceptor is that it would be able to give us a really good view and a really good measurements at one of these new comets. And the plan is it will also carry two interplanetary CubeSats. So we'll have not one, but three spacecraft probing this comet, whether or not it's a one belonging to our sun or it's an interstellar comet. All we've got to do is hope that in 10 years' time, we get one that's suitable coming into the solar system. And the chances of that, we think, are quite high, because, of course, we're building new telescopes to allow us to detect these comets coming in.
So does that mean we've got a better handle? We've got two objects that have come into the solar system. We've got the first one from a couple of years ago, Oumuamua, and then we've got this one, Borisov, that's come in this year and swung past. Oumuamua, an asteroid. This is a comet, so they're different types of objects.
Hold your horses.
is that not the case?
All the signs are was that Oumuamua was icy and cometary, but just inactive.
Oh, okay. And is that because it didn't get close enough to the sun to become active, or...?
No, it got very close to the sun. It went even closer than the planet Mercury, although we did not see it at that point. We only discovered it after it had passed the Earth and was heading back out to interstellar space. But it's also quite small, and it's quite possible, looking at current models and our data, that this was one of these inert comets, which was so small that it covered itself in an inert crust, preventing many of the interior ices to escape. Although a subsequent analysis of its trajectory as it left the solar system showed that it did experience what we call non-gravitational forces, which we see with active comets, albeit at a very weak level.
And is that something that happens to comets? I guess we won't know for sure for Oumuamua. It's long gone now. We're heading out of our solar system again, I guess. Is that inert comet, is that something that happens just by comets that are particularly small? Or is it something that happens sort of almost towards the end of a comet's life? Do we have a feel for that?
But that's a very good question. We're not sure, to be honest. Oumuamua was about as small as any comet we've actually recognised as a definite comet in our own solar system. It was quite a small object. But we do suspect, and we have good evidence, that some comets in our own solar system do end their lives that way as well. Basically, they dry out, their surfaces dry out and form a crust around the comet that prevents any more interior ice from being heated up and escaping as gas. So we believe that happens, and indeed when we look at the data from the European Space Agency's Rosetta mission, we can see the surface of that comet that it orbited for 2 years. Some parts of it were clearly very freely in releasing gas and other material, but some parts of it were relatively inert and let out very little stuff because you had this relatively hard and thick crust on the surface. So, but we're still really at the early days of understanding how these comets become like that. We've speculated about this for decades, but it's only now we're starting to get those measurements that allow us to test those theories.
Looking to what either Comet Interceptor will do or future telescopes looking for these things, you meant we've got two of these objects now that have come through the solar system. Doing statistics based on two is somewhat, well, not risky, but there's a lot of uncertainties there when you try and extrapolate from two objects to many. But do we have a feel for how many of these interstellar visitors we might have, and how likely it is there'll be something that we can either observe in great detail or that Comet Interceptor might be able to go and find?
Well, our problem is at the moment that although we had two visitors, they were so different in activity and appearance that it's quite hard right now, although we're working on it, to try to put these two objects in a single bin, if you like, a single class of object. But certainly what it looks like is that if we look at Oumuamua type objects, the solar system right now is full of thousands of them passing through, but most of them are too small and too faint for us to detect with current telescopes. We were lucky with Oumuamua 2 years ago. With Borisov, because it's releasing so much material, and it's probably physically larger, the core of the nucleus is physically larger than Oumuamua, then we can see that a long way off. And it's implying, however, that because they're easy to see, that there won't be quite as many of these active interstellar comets. But putting everything together, we suspect that by the time our new sky survey facility starts up, the Large Synoptic Survey Telescope, at the end of 2022, we may be finding regularly these objects about once a year or so. So we've gone from decades where we were looking for these objects and didn't find any, to now within a few years we may be finding one a year, and we're really quite excited about that prospect.
Now studies of Borisov and even comets from our solar system rely on using telescopes to look at things moving across the sky. And in fact, these things are discovered by finding objects that are moving across the sky in astronomical images, or between astronomical images. That recently has become somewhat harder because, again, over the last few months, we've had launches of these groups of satellites, sometimes called constellations of satellites, all launching together and going around the sky in massive clouds of dozens of satellites together. Those move between images or create streaks across them. They must make looking for things moving across the sky somewhat more difficult for astronomers like yourself.
Well, at the moment, the effect is minimal because the constellations that are being launched at the moment by SpaceX consist of perhaps 60 satellites at a time. And first of all, you only detect them in the hours after sunset or the hours before sunrise, when it's still relatively dark for us on Earth, but the satellites up there are illuminated by the sun. And the total amount of sky that they cover at the moment is still pretty small. But we are concerned about it because if future plans go ahead, there'll be not just this constellation set up with several thousand satellites going around the Earth, but there'll be more than one of these constellations. And certainly for part of the time when we are using our telescopes searching for comets and asteroids, including near-Earth asteroids, which could pose a threat to us, we could miss some objects because of those satellite trails across our data. We're hoping it doesn't have that much of an effect. And in terms of global astronomy, I think it's still going to be okay. But for moving objects, and particularly for the oddballs we want to find, such as dangerous near-Earth asteroids or the next interstellar visitor, we're slightly concerned that we might miss crucial evidence crucial data that allows us to detect these objects in the first place.
Apart from just extrapolating the number of launches, is there any data on that yet?
Not at the moment, but of course we can do those calculations, and studies are being performed right now to judge the impact on it. The impact should be quite small on average, we believe. First of all, these satellites you only see when they reflect sunlight, but of course it's dark for you on the ground, so you only see them just after sunset and just before sunrise. So for most of the night, our survey telescopes won't be affected. But of course, generally, you do find many interesting objects in those hours, the post-sunset and pre-dawn hours. And we are certainly worried that if we've not just got one mega constellation up there, but two, three, there are a number of proposals to launch these things, then it could be those hours end up being quite severely affected by these new constellations. But as I said, we're still looking at the problem, saying that it's not clear what we can do about it should this actually occur, because this is one of those unfortunate interfaces between the commercial world and the scientific world.
It's difficult, I suppose, because one of the reasons for launching these constellations is said to be, at least on paper, to provide, you know, free or very cheap internet to the world, which sounds like a very noble goal. To do, but there's obviously this catch that it damages some science. And actually, some of that science is of global importance, because those hours after dusk and before dawn are when it's easier to look at things, or when you need to be looking to find things that are not too far from the sun. And it's those things that aren't too far from the sun in the sky that are the ones that could potentially come and hit the Earth. So those can be quite important times, I guess, for looking for these near-Earth asteroids that might come and hit us.
That's right. Of course, we search for near-Earth asteroids with our current survey telescopes all the way through the night. But because of the way the orbits work, there's a couple of sweet spots quite close to the sun in the sky, which you can only observe just after sunset and before sunrise. And searching those sweet spots where you're more likely to find potentially hazardous objects, potentially hazardous asteroids, would be the ones that would be most affected by these constellations. But again, we have to wait and see, because at the moment, we know it's not a problem, but we just have to extrapolate those numbers and work it out. We are concerned, I must admit.
There have certainly been some images around from survey telescopes showing that when these do go across, it does. They do certainly make quite a big impact on the images.
It's also the fact that those images, although they look bad, when you actually add up how much of the image is covered by satellite tracks, it's actually a very small fraction, because each satellite track is actually quite thin. So by eye, it looks bad. In reality, you only lose actually a relatively smaller fraction of your data. But it still may be important data that you are losing. And so whole cost-benefit analysis has to be calculated. It may be in the end that the global advantage of everybody in the world having internet access is somewhat outweighed by at least a loss of a little bit of science. That's something for society to judge, I suspect, rather than just a bunch of astronomers.
Is there a risk that these satellites get misidentified as passing visitors or near-Earth objects or something? Or are they just going to be moving far too fast to be anything like that?
Yeah, no, the good news is that at least we won't confuse them with near-Earth asteroids. All of these satellites are so close to the Earth and moving apparently so fast across the sky, they're moving much faster than even near-Earth asteroids that even would be on an approach trajectory to us. So the danger of confusion is one we're not worried about. It's just that the loss of those pixels containing those images of those asteroids and those comets and anything else that's happening out there that we might want to mitigate against.
We'll hold off on judgment to see how bad the impact is until we know quite how many of these things are. But as you say, reasons to be somewhat concerned about the possible future impacts. Professor Alan Fitzsimmons from Queen's University Belfast, thanks very much.
It's been a pleasure.
That's it for this month. Don't forget, you can find past episodes and subscribe to the podcast at pythagastro.uk. Until next month, goodbye.
You've been listening to Pythagorean Astronomy, an extended version of this month's Astronomy Roundup from Pythagoras' Trousers, a weekly science and technology radio show presented by me, Rhys Phillips. You can catch up on full episodes of Pythagoras' Trousers, subscribe to our podcast and get in touch by going to www.pythagoras-trousers.radio.fm.